are the origins of the coronavirus? Scientists need to know, but politicians are making it tough.
This issue is sort of sucking the oxygen out of the requirement that we improve international cooperation.
Also today, she lives in Canada, her wife is in the U.S. Meeting during the pandemic isn't easy.
It's like, you know, when you have a bad day, you want to vent to your partner, not on FaceTime.
There's just no end in sight, yeah. Which makes it difficult to plan our lives.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one small spot in Washington state where they can meet. And an environmental bright spot, Brazil's Atlantic Forest is roaring back to life.
If this was a TV show, I would show to you some before and after pictures.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The calls for an independent investigation to explore the origins of the coronavirus are growing louder. And so are the warnings that a politicized investigation could backfire, making global collaboration to prevent the next pandemic more difficult. David Fidler is a senior fellow for global health and cybersecurity at the Council on Foreign Relations. David, the revival of the debate about whether this new coronavirus began in a lab in Wuhan, China, has become deeply politicized. What impact is that having on global cooperation in public health?
This issue is sort of sucking the oxygen out of the requirement that we improve international cooperation on pandemic issues and global health security. This, unfortunately, has been a feature of the pandemic from the very beginning, and this recent flare-up about whether or not the lab leak theory is credible is simply a continuation of something that's been debilitating in the responses to the pandemic from the very beginning.
But isn't there sort of a catch-22? I mean, we need to keep in mind that there's no evidence that's been presented to support the hypothesis that the virus was engineered in or leaked from a lab. But independent inquiry remains key to ruling this out and to understand how to prevent outbreaks in the future. Isn't that the dilemma we're in here?
Oh, yes. As I said, it's been a dilemma from the very beginning. China was not transparent about many aspects of this outbreak from January 2020 or even earlier. And the expectation that now China is going to be fully transparent with regards to an investigation of the origins of this virus seems a political fantasy. It's not as if I think the United States and the Biden administration doesn't understand that, which means that these continued calls for an independent investigation have some other purpose, and that purpose is geopolitical. It's not really a purpose designed to improve our ability to deal with this pandemic and to prepare for the next one.
It's so tricky, though, because you still have to have the independent inquiry to rule it out so everybody feels okay. But you're saying that even asking for the independent inquiry is political because it's been so political from the beginning. So where do we go with this?
My suggestion and proposal for the United States has been to create some global health detente with China, to reach out to China and begin to try to have some cooperation, some communication with regards to the ongoing pandemic as well as the future pandemic. This is a way of competing with China. This isn't in any way, shape, or form meant to be some sort of appeasement of China, which I think, again, is part of the language that's coming into this debate about, you know, how loudly can we, you know, yell at China and make China out to be a bad actor. There are different ways of competing with China and putting China on its back foot. I think if we reached out to China to begin to create some global health detente, turn down this geopolitical heat, I think that's a much smarter way for the United States to compete rather than continuing to ask for something that we know will not happen.
What would global health detente with China look like concretely on the ground?
I think the United States and China have responsibilities as the leading great powers in the international system to start blazing that trail and to begin to have some bilateral communications about some of what I call functional needs that we've got, improving surveillance, improving information sharing, improving capabilities with regards to identifying and responding to potential emerging infectious diseases, working on improving some of the functional capabilities of the World Health Organization with regards to health emergencies, potentially collaborating on the next generation of pharmaceutical interventions, including vaccines that we might need for pandemics down the road. So there's a lot of things on the epidemiological, scientific, functional level that need to be done. But if you don't have the political space to do that, either bilaterally or, for example, in the World Health Organization, global health is in for a world of trouble over the next decade.
How do you create that political space?
You send Anthony Fauci to Beijing. That would be an enormous statement by the Biden administration that it wants to engage in direct bilateral talks with the Chinese government about global health security. Look, the Biden administration has already done this in connection with climate change. Why not with regards to pandemics? We face two catastrophic level problems right now in the world. The first are pandemics, and we see from COVID-19 how disastrous that can be for the world. The second is climate change. The Biden administration has reached out bilaterally to China on climate change. It has not done so, as far as I'm aware, in terms of global health security and pandemics. And I'm scratching my head as to why that's the case, when I think if we did that, not only could we create this functional space, I actually think that's a better way to compete with China on this issue in this new world that we find ourselves in.
David Fidler is a senior fellow for global health and cybersecurity at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
There's no wall or barrier along most of the border between the United States and Canada, but for more than a year now, crossing that very porous border has been heavily restricted because of the pandemic. Trucks can still pass, but restrictions on non-essential travel remain in place. That's putting a strain on many families and married couples separated by the border and on U.S.-Canada relations. Reporter Benjamin Payne brings us this story from Blaine, Washington, at a unique spot along the U.S.-Canada border.
Just off the coast of Boundary Bay, in a park, stands a six-story-high concrete arch, Peace Arch. Part of it lies in the U.S., part of it in Canada. Inside the arch is an engraving, "May these gates never be closed." And sure enough, there are two iron gates inside the arch, both swung open. It turns out this monument is more than just a symbol. Peace Arch Park has become a place where families split by the border come to reunite. Alexis Gurr is unpacking her car for a day at the park.
Blankets to stay warm, a heater, propane tanks, food, pillows. So it's like day camping, basically.
She's meeting up with her wife, Katrina, who has pitched a tent to celebrate Alexis's 33rd birthday. Last year, they did the same thing, same place. Alexis is American, Katrina, Canadian. For the past 14 months, the two have met here countless times, taking advantage of a long-standing agreement that allows Canadians to come to the American side of the park without passing through any border checkpoint, and, more importantly, without having to undergo a two-week quarantine once they return to Canada.
Who can take 2 weeks off work? And I don't have, like, vacation pay or anything, so I can't. I'd go up a lot more if I had the money and the resources to do so.
And that's the thing. It's not that it's impossible for couples to legally cross the border outside the park, given that there are exemptions for American family members to enter Canada. It's that it's impractical and expensive for many to do so.
We're paying for two different lives in two different countries, so it's expensive, it's crappy. It's like, you know, when you have a bad day, you want to vent to your partner not on FaceTime.
There's just no end in sight, yeah. Which makes it difficult to plan our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Katrina is trying to get a green card to live in the U.S., but the process has slowed down during the pandemic. And so have talks between the two countries, says Edward Alden, a professor of U.S.-Canada relations at Western Washington University.
There's been no evidence of serious cross-border cooperation, cost-benefit calculations, the development of metrics to allow some sorts of gradual reopening. I have been truly shocked by the lack of cooperation.
Before the pandemic, no visa was necessary for citizens of these two countries to enter the other. I ask Alden when the last time the border was this restricted.
War of 1812? I mean, I'm not being facetious.
He says that the U.S. and Canada have spent the last half century building closer relationships, from free trade agreements to counterterrorism efforts. Not even the 9/11 terrorist attacks were enough to shut down the border. But the outbreak of the pandemic was.
And to see the complete breakdown of border cooperation has been truly shocking. I mean, I think it's created a fairly significant rift between the two countries that is going to be hard to repair.
It's not just the quarantine requirement in Canada that's causing headaches for families. Because of the pandemic, the U.S. land border is closed, with no exemptions for most families. That's been a problem for Devin Weber, a U.S. citizen who lives with her toddler son and Canadian husband in Montreal. Devin's family lives in New York City.
God forbid something happened with my parents. They're in their 70s. My husband couldn't drive down with us to deal with that. And it terrifies me. And if a Canadian can fly into the United States for any reason with a negative COVID test to just go on vacation at Disney World, my husband should be able to cross the land border in our own private vehicle to see our family.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security, which oversees the U.S. border, declined to comment on whether there are any plans in the works to reopen the land border. A spokesperson for the Public Health Agency of Canada said in a statement that Canada is exploring quarantine exemptions for vaccinated foreign nationals, but that for now, the current restrictions will remain in place. Back at Peace Arch Park, two other couples have tents set up, besides Alexis and Katrina Gurr.
Hopefully within the next month or two, they have some sort of change. Otherwise, it's going to be another shitty summer at the park.
I used to get my hopes up.
She did.
Like a year ago.
Yep.
I was like, it'll just be another month.
Yep.
But it's, yeah, we'll just wait and see.
Come late July, they'll be celebrating their one-year wedding anniversary. A marriage so far spent entirely under a pandemic. For The World, I'm Benjamin Payne in Blaine, Washington.
As Canadian and American families grapple with separations, one man is taking it upon himself to get the border open again. Florida retiree John Adams owns a property in British Columbia. He's been producing and paying for ads that aired recently in Michigan, New York, and Washington State.
Prime Minister Trudeau and President Biden, I clean restaurants for a living. Because the border is still closed, I lost my job.
Prime Minister Trudeau, we own a home in Canada we haven't seen in over a year because the border is still closed.
Adams is also raising money to run ads on the Canadian side, too.
Stop hurting our economy and costing us jobs. Open the border now.
The closure of the U.S.-Canada border is being extended on a month-to-month basis. Both Ottawa and Washington weigh in on the decision. That system has been criticized by Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, who represents New York State on Capitol Hill. Earlier this month, Schumer spoke from the Rainbow Bridge on the New York side of Niagara Falls.
The monthly extensions, which we've heard, you know, you've read about, heard about every month, have no rhyme or reason. They confuse people. They don't let people plan. They frustrate thousands of Western New Yorkers and Southern Ontarians who depend on the border crossing.
Despite the pushback, the latest extension came just last week. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau defended that decision.
The situation is changing rapidly, and we're adjusting constantly to what is the right measures for Canadians to get that balance right between keeping people safe and restoring a semblance of normality and the economic activity that we all rely on.
But what do other Canadians think? Plug your ears, John Adams, the man buying advertisements, because you might not like the sound of this. A survey from the Angus Reid Institute found that only around 20% of Canadians wanted the border to reopen immediately. On the other extreme, 20% of Canadians surveyed said they wanted it to remain closed until next year. Yesterday, activist climate investors shocked the establishment and invaded the board of ExxonMobil.
I think it really will be seen as the day when, in many respects, everything changed.
We look at the future of big oil just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Some big wins for the climate this week. Activist investors captured at least two seats on the board of ExxonMobil. A Dutch court ordered Shell to reduce carbon emissions. And Chevron's investors told the company to cut its greenhouse gas emissions. Andrew Logan has been following these events closely. He's the senior director for oil and gas at Ceres, a nonprofit that works with companies to move towards sustainable practices. Andrew, first, who exactly was behind this move to get climate investor activists on Exxon's board, and how were they able to pull it off?
So the fund behind the campaign at Exxon is actually quite tiny and quite new. They're an outfit called Engine One. They were founded by former hedge fund activists who wanted to bring that approach to the world of climate change. And, you know, while they are a small fund, you know, I think they owned only about 0.02% of Exxon shares, they clearly were able to tap into a huge well of discontent among very large investors over the direction that, ExxonMobil has taken on climate change and more broadly. So in a way, this was a David and Goliath fight between a very small fund and a very large company. But at the same time, it really built on a series of forces that have come into play in recent years, where some of the world's largest investors are now seeing climate change as an urgent priority.
So this small investment group, Engine One, they just kind of work the shareholders and try to say, hey, vote for these two board members?
Yes. I mean, it sounds like a bit of an oxymoron, corporate democracy. And normally it is, right? Normally the votes at annual meetings are stacked against opponents or those hoping to challenge the company. But in this case, Engine One was able to make the system work for them. And the argument they put forward that Exxon has been on the wrong path for a long time, and therefore a real shakeup is needed on the company's board, was enough to convince the company's largest investors to line up behind them.
So now that these two people are on board, what will change? I mean, what can they actually do?
A lot will depend on how the rest of the board reacts to this election. On the one hand, you know, having two new members on a 12-person board, you know, doesn't constitute a new majority. On the other hand, this election was such a clear rebuke to the company's strategy and to the board's strategy in addressing climate change that I would be very surprised if the board as a whole doesn't take a very hard look at what the company's plans are and makes real changes. You know, Exxon has been approaching climate change as though it's a 100-year problem and that one for which incremental solutions are sufficient. I think what these new candidates want to do is to push the company to act much more swiftly, to set much more aggressive greenhouse gas reduction targets, to move away from investing only in oil and gas and diversify into other sorts of energy, to really position itself behind policy solutions for climate change. So I think they're looking for a wholesale change in the company's approach in everything from how it allocates capital to how it interacts with shareholders and the government.
Besides the board changes at Exxon, Shell and Chevron are being forced to curb their carbon emissions. When you add it all up, what does this mean for big oil?
So yesterday was a huge day in the history of big oil. I think it really will be seen as the day when, in many respects, everything changed. We saw a series of legal and financial trends, all of them very long in the making, come together to send a message to companies that even those companies that see themselves as leaders in this industry aren't doing enough. Investors are clearly losing patience and are now willing to support ambitious shareholder proposals like the one that we saw do so well at Chevron yesterday and that we saw do so well at ConocoPhillips a couple of weeks ago. We're also seeing investors being willing to shake up boards. So it was a day when sort of everyone was punished in this sector. And I think it's now clear that what the industry saw as leadership still falls short. And, you know, how individual companies and the industry as a whole choose to respond to this clear signal, you know, will go a long way toward determining which companies thrive through the coming transition and which don't.
We're speaking with Andrew Logan. He's a senior director for oil and gas at Ceres, a nonprofit that works with companies to move towards sustainable practices. Do you see any of these companies shifting from being oil companies to energy companies that invest in renewable energy sources like solar and wind exclusively?
Sure. Well, I think that is the trend we are seeing among European companies. Certainly BP has said that it is aiming to become an energy company and not an oil and gas company. And they even have a target that by 2030, they're going to reduce their oil production by 40%, which is amazing that a company would set a target to actually shrink what is now its core business. Other European oil and gas companies have laid out similar strategies, aiming to become energy companies, not oil and gas companies. But the U.S. oil companies really have stood apart on this. They have consistently said that they see no real future for themselves outside of oil and gas. And I think up until recently, investors have bought that idea and have given them a bit of a pass. You know, I think what this year's votes have made clear is that the industry's time, and the U.S. industry's time in particular, is running short, and that simply continuing with a business as usual approach as strictly an oil and gas company isn't going to be enough for investors.
What do these changes mean in terms of jobs? I mean, these companies employ a lot of people. How could it affect the number of people they're actually employing?
So the activists and the investors who have been pressuring ExxonMobil ultimately want the company to succeed and to thrive in the future. And that means making changes now to position the company for a lower carbon world. And ultimately, more jobs will be preserved and potentially added if the company acts sooner rather than waiting until it's too late to act. So if I were an employee of a company like Exxon, I would want the activists to succeed because it's sort of the one way that there is a chance of Exxon really positioning itself to thrive in a lower carbon future. It's also the case that as companies transition from doing just oil and gas to doing other things, that jobs will shift and some jobs will be lost. And an important part of what investors say to companies that I think often gets lost in the coverage is that, you know, employees and communities need to be taken care of during that transition. What we need to have is a just and fair transition. And I think it's partly the responsibility of the companies involved to make sure that that is handled in a just and equitable way. If you look at, for instance, a company like Shell, part of its transition strategy is getting rid of a lot of its refineries. Some of those refineries will simply be sold to other parties and they'll continue to operate, but some will be shut down. And that's potentially a huge loss for those communities and obviously for the workers who staff them. And that shouldn't be lost and those people should be helped, but it's not clear that companies are as focused on that problem as they should be.
Andrew, finally, I just want to ask you just this basic question. Do you think this week qualifies as a real watershed moment for big oil?
I do. I've been doing this work for 20 years, and this is one of those moments that does feel like a tipping point, that forces that have been building for a very long time have finally reached a critical mass where a lot of change is happening very quickly. So I'm optimistic that we will one day look back at this year and at this week in particular as a time when investors fundamentally change the relationship to the oil and gas industry, and smart companies will have gotten the message and changed tack.
Andrew Logan is the Senior Director for Oil and Gas at the Boston-based organization Ceres, a nonprofit that works with companies to move towards sustainable practices. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The World. Undocumented Haitians in the U.S. are now protected from deportation, temporarily. Haitians who have built their lives in the U.S. are asking for permanent protections.
I think if they see the faces of the people, it'll help them to make a decision that would allow us to live, to become American.
That's ahead on The World. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Some relief for undocumented Haitians living in the U.S. They're now protected from deportation for the next 18 months. Last weekend, the Biden administration reestablished their legal right to be in the U.S. under Temporary Protected Status, or TPS. That's given to people from countries facing political unrest, environmental disaster, or other challenges that make it dangerous for them to return. Now, many other immigrant communities are wondering if their turn is next. The World's Daisy Contreras has this story.
Julio Perez points to the White House in the distance. He's in D.C. at Black Lives Matter Plaza. He's surrounded by hundreds of other people. A justice walk, he says. They're asking President Biden to grant him and thousands of others permanent residency. That was in February this year. Perez is from El Salvador, and he's been living in Boston for decades. He's had temporary protected status, or TPS, ever since an earthquake in 2001 blocked him from returning home safely. He's renewed that TPS status for years, and it's let him have a work permit and not fear deportation as much. But that changed under the Trump administration. It tried ending TPS for El Salvador and other countries like Haiti and Honduras. Trump argued they were safe and that people should return. Haiti, however, was and still is going through a major political crisis and a rise in crime. Perez says that's where the nightmare began.
Toda esta comunidad de estos países logró comprar sus casas, unos fueron al colegio, se graduaron algo, estudiaron.
Immigrants with TPS who'd built careers, bought homes, and went to college now face deportation, he says, including him. But legal fights against Trump's decision have kept the TPS program in place, for now. The Biden administration has also taken a first move toward restoring TPS, starting by granting the status to Haitians again. That's given other immigrants like Perez hope that they'll be next, but when is unclear. The Department of Homeland Security, which oversees TPS, hasn't commented if it's considering any new designations. Immigrant communities are also asking for more. TPS must be renewed every 18 months. They want something permanent, says Shelley Clemenceau. She's a Haitian TPS holder living in San Rafael, California. She's been in the U.S. since she was 6 years old. The last year was tough.
I feared for my home. I feared for everything. I was in fear. I also feared for my baby because I was pregnant. I was pregnant that entire year. And I was trying not to be stressed out to the point where nothing would happen.
Clemenceau says she's lucky she was able to keep her job at a bank all through the pandemic and provide for her newborn son. She says she hopes the Biden administration understands how stressful the wait is.
I think if they see the faces of the people that this affect, it'll help them to make a decision that makes sense, a decision that would allow us to be here, to live, to become American.
That decision to grant or to take away TPS can seem arbitrary, says Hattie Gassama. She's with UnDocu Black Network, a group that advocates for undocumented Black immigrants.
There's no way you can compare one country's atrocities or harms that folks are facing or dangers as to another. You know, you can't say this is worse than another.
Which is why Gassama says she'd like to see new countries added to the administration's TPS list. Countries like Cameroon, Mauritania, and St. Vincent, countries that have not received TPS status before. These are places that are temporarily unsafe, especially for those who are in danger of being deported, says Gassama.
But on our end, we know that the fight does not stop until we are able to ensure that all members of our community are safe. Like we always say, like we're not free until all of us are free.
As for Shelley Clemenceau, who's from Haiti, she says she'll continue sharing her experiences with others.
We are people, you know, as TPS holder, our lives are not temporary.
For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
Haiti and the Dominican Republic share an island, and soon that island could be separated by a steel and concrete border wall. We have that story for you tomorrow on The World. Let's turn to Iraq now. The 100-degree summer days have started there, but that's not holding back protesters in Baghdad. Thousands have been marching in city squares to protest a wave of killings that took the lives of activists and demonstrators. The protesters are blaming militia groups supported by Iran. They say for too long, these groups have acted with impunity. The World's Shirin Jafari has been following this. Shirin, what's the latest?
Carol, like you say, tensions are high in Iraq and especially in Baghdad, the capital. Protesters have been out this week chanting anti-government slogans. They were carrying banners and the Iraqi flag, and they are frustrated with the lack of response from the government. The security forces didn't hold back. They used tear gas and bullets, and that ended up killing at least two protesters and injuring many more.
Give us some background on these protests. How did they get started and what's fueling them?
Sure. So these protests began back in October 2019. Back then, thousands of people participated in protests that went on for weeks. These were some of the biggest demonstrations that Iraq had seen since the U.S. invasion in 2003. And these protesters wanted an end to corruption, government mismanagement, and lack of services. But one other key demand that these protesters had was that the government stands up to some of the powerful militias that have been operating in Iraq for a few years now.
Who are these militias?
So a lot of these militias were created and supported by Iran, Iraq's neighbor. And initially, their goal was to counter the Islamic State, which was taking over cities in Iraq. But over time, these militias became more and more powerful. And when ISIS lost control of territory in Iraq, these militias didn't go away. They started going after activists and basically anybody who speaks out against them. And the Iraqi government has more or less been unable to stop them. About 80 activists, Carol, have been assassinated in Iraq since 2019. And critics of these militias say they are the ones behind these targeted killings.
So these protests against these militias have been going on for a while. Have they actually achieved anything?
They did lead to the resignation of Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi and the appointment of a new Prime Minister, Mustafa Al-Kadhimi. But here's the thing, Carol. Protesters say Kadhimi hasn't been able to deliver the changes that they wanted either. And these militias continue to kill Iraqis. This week, the protesters were using the hashtag WhoKilledMe, sort of trying to bring attention to these killings that just keep happening.
What are some of the broader implications of these protests in Iraq?
Iraq is a country where both the U.S. and Iran have a presence. The U.S. has military bases and a small number of troops. Iran also has influence through militias, politicians, and powerful cleriques. So anytime there is a rise in tensions in Iraq, there is also a possibility that it could escalate into a more serious regional conflict. And I would think that Washington is watching these developments in Iraq closely.
The world's Shirin Jafari, thanks for the update.
You're welcome, Carol.
Deforestation in the tropics is on the rise. According to one accounting, it's risen 50% since the early 2000s. But there are some bright spots. A recent global survey found that over the past 20 years, an area of forest the size of the Netherlands has grown back in the eastern part of Brazil. That's today on The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Deforestation of the Amazon rainforest grabs the headlines, but successful reforestation efforts in another Brazilian rainforest provides a case study of what can work. Here's the world's Anna Kusmer.
The Atlantic rainforest stretches from northeastern Brazil down to northern Argentina. Before European contact, it was twice the size of Texas. But it was cleared during colonial expansion, making way for Brazil's megacities and farming. Only around 15% of the forest remains. But in recent decades, large swaths have been growing back. In the years that Ricardo Gomez-Sizer has worked on the Atlantic forest, he's seen landscapes utterly transformed.
If this was a TV show, I would show to you some before and after pictures.
Sizer is a researcher at the Institute for Ecological Research in eastern Brazil.
At the beginning, it's pretty much pasture land. You have some isolated trees now and there, but it's pretty much grasses. And it's very hard for trees to go there and sprout. If you are a tree seed, you really don't want to be there.
Sizer's organization is the biggest conservation program in the region. It pays local people to fence off plots of land, usually next to standing forests, pull up the grass, and replant native trees.
The trees, once they grow, they start shading the area. And these grasses, they cannot stand shading.
Within a couple years, what was a pasture is now a forest. And other species start moving in. Like the blonde-crested woodpecker, the plush-crested jay, and the pale-breasted thrush.
You see, for example, a cacti, you know, at the feet of some trees, and you're like, wait a minute, we don't plant cacti. What is it doing here 2 years later? And it's a bird that brought it, or a bat, we don't know.
The money comes from the government and conservation funding from outside Brazil. The result is the largest forest regrowth project in the world. Robin Chasden is a forest ecologist at the University of the Sunshine Coast in Australia, who says involving local people is what makes Atlantic forest conservation so special.
This is the model that's going to bring us forward. It really requires very active engagement of communities in the landscape, and also communities outside of the landscape who are big stakeholders in what happens.
NGOs, government officials, and farmers were brought in from the beginning. Local people were trained to grow and protect trees. They learned agroforestry techniques, ways of growing food while keeping forests intact.
The idea of planning, of spatial planning and engaging stakeholders is really not new, but there are not very many examples where it has worked well. often the process gets diverted and becomes all about what one major stakeholder wants to do. And that has to do with money and power.
In this case, that didn't happen because of strong local institutions that were committed to representing local people's needs.
The Atlantic Forest is probably one of the strongest beacons we have when it comes to forest restoration.
Will Baldwin Cantello is with the World Wildlife Foundation. He's part of a global project that mapped all of the forest regrowth since 2000 and found the Atlantic Forest was a bright spot. Baldwin Cantello says saving and growing trees is essential for slowing down global temperature rise.
Deforestation itself is around 10% of global emissions, so that's a kind of must-win prize. We don't just have to think about reducing the losses of forests, we can also think about allowing them to bounce back.
Mariana Oliveira is a forest expert with the World Resources Institute in Sao Paulo. She says these restoration projects are working, but 70% of Brazil's population live in the historic footprint of the Atlantic Forest.
When you see the Christ in the Rio de Janeiro, it's the Atlantic rainforest. And we have like the biggest cities in Brazil are located in the Atlantic rainforest.
And that means there's still lots of deforestation happening near all these population centers. Even when the land is restored, Oliveira says the biodiversity and carbon sequestration potential of a forest doesn't bounce back immediately.
It will take time to start to have these benefits again.
Brazil is a leader in forest loss, but it also has a lot to teach the world about growing forests back again. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
The Big Fix is our weekly look at solutions to climate change and how people and organizations around the planet are tackling it. Find more stories at theworld.org/bigfix. One glimpse of the bright teal, green, and red illustrations, and you know the book, The Very Hungry Caterpillar. I love that book. Eric Carle wrote and illustrated it in 1969. He died this week at age 91. Carle was American, but he witnessed traumatic events as a kid in Germany during and after World War II, and those shaped his life. To discuss his work and early life, we're joined by Michelle Martin. She's the Beverly Cleary Professor for Children and Youth Services at the University of Washington. Michelle, I have to ask, when you train early childhood education teachers, how often do they recommend The Very Hungry Caterpillar?
You know, I think The Very Hungry Caterpillar is a staple. I've taught teachers or pre-service teachers, and I teach librarians now. And Eric Carle's The Very Hungry Caterpillar and many of his books are really sort of a starting point for early literacy. So I would say that's just one of those ones you have to know.
It's funny because even standing here, you know, talking to you, I can just visualize that image on the cover. It's just so familiar. How much of a global impact did Eric Carle's books have?
Well, given that they've been translated into 70 different languages and the Very Hungry Caterpillar just itself, I read this morning that 170 million copies of that book have been sold. So, yeah, I would say pretty global impact from The Very Hungry Caterpillar. But I think because of that book, you know, if you have a illustrator that's done well, that can serve as a sort of a gateway to other books by that author. So I think that Eric Carle is probably a household name in a lot of countries.
Michelle, what happened in Eric Carle's childhood that was so traumatic?
Well, when he was young, his mother was homesick and decided to move back to Germany. But then his father was recruited into the Nazi army and came back 85 pounds. And he was a broken man. And Eric was really impacted by his father. Some of the reasons why he has so many books about small insects is that he says that his father taught him to look closely at things and really to pay attention. So his father had been a big influence. And when he came back from the war, a very different person, it highly impacted Eric Carle. He also had to dig some ditches himself for the Nazi army. He says that some of the colors that he relies on bring that darkness. He calls it like dirty green. But also, I think that there's always a sense of positivity and hope in the story, regardless of what it takes to get there.
His books can almost exist without any type. I mean, the pictures really tell it all.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, why they also appeal to pre-literate children, because, you know, you can read it a couple times and the kid can tell you the story, or you don't have to read it and they can just tell you what's happening. And so interactivity is a hallmark of Eric Carle's work.
What is Eric Carle's legacy in children's literature?
I remember sharing with my niece the very grouchy ladybug. And, you know, when the child is learning how to tell time, or, you know, there's counting in many of his books, there are lots of different things to pay attention to and to do. And you're always rewarded in an Eric Carle book for close observation. So I think that's some of the legacy that he leaves.
Michelle, what's your favorite Eric Carle book?
Ooh, maybe Papa Get the Moon for Me, Please. Because of that gatefold illustration that goes straight up to the moon. I think I like that one best.
Michelle Martin is the Beverly Cleary Professor for Children and Youth Services at the University of Washington. Thanks for speaking with us, Michelle.
Thanks so much for having me.
This week, we're marking 1 year since George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis. On our program, we're taking note of other social justice movements around the world. That includes a greater awareness of caste, social class hierarchy in South Asia that many say has been imported to the U.S. Now in California, there's a growing effort to add caste to anti-discrimination policies. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports.
Protests around the world last summer weren't just about police brutality. People wanted to confront racism and other forms of discrimination. In California, officials with the Department of Fair Employment and Housing initiated a groundbreaking discrimination lawsuit. It was against technology giant Cisco Systems.
When everyone and everything is connected,
that's really beautiful.
Anything is possible.
Good morning.
Cisco, the bridge to possible.
The suit alleged discrimination based on caste. It defined caste as, quote, a strict Hindu social and religious hierarchy. In India and other countries, caste was based on ancestry and determined a person's socioeconomic status. The lawsuit said that two Cisco supervisors, who were Indian, had outed a third Indian employee's lower caste. They let it get around that he had benefited from affirmative action back in India. When that employee complained, the supervisors denied him opportunities for advancement. Cisco says its internal investigation found no evidence of discrimination. But the California lawsuit got people talking. There are more than 4 million Indian Americans in the U.S. Most are upper caste. Historically, they're the ones who had the means to migrate. Samir Kalra is a lawyer with the Hindu American Foundation. It filed a legal brief against the Cisco lawsuit.
Only to say that the state could not define Hinduism and was incorrect in saying that caste-based discrimination or caste is tied to Hinduism, and what we said was a violation of the Constitution.
The state eventually dropped the federal charge and continued the suit under state laws.
If you fast forward some months from there, then you saw in different places, you know, this idea of creating a new separate category, anti-discrimination category, specifically around caste popping up.
Student leaders on campuses across California mobilized to pass resolutions recognizing caste as a protected category on their campuses. Manmeet Singh Chahal helped lead the effort at California Polytechnic State University.
It kind of just snowballed.
Singh Chahal was among a group that took the issue to the Cal State Student Association, or CSSA. It's the official voice for 500,000 university students in California. The CSSA agreed to consider a resolution that asks trustees to add caste to their anti-discrimination policy. It points out that without a specific category for caste, data won't be collected about how often the discrimination happens.
We were kind of able to sail through and get our resolution passed on our campus. Then it was until the CSSA meeting that I came across like a huge resistance, that large-scale mobilization to shut it down.
People from across the state of seemingly every age and background called into the Student Association's Zoom meeting on April 10. It lasted more than 3 hours, even though each speaker was limited to 30 seconds. Those against the resolution said that caste was really a system imposed by the British when they colonized India, and putting caste in university policy would just create a problem in the U.S. that doesn't exist. Here's an edited sample of some of their arguments.
Giving rise to this resolution would mean ingraining the British idea of castes into the minds of students.
Bringing this concept up, which isn't very prevalent in American society today, will lead to social bullying, as it will highlight another division in my Hindu community.
CSSA is establishing a double standard which is inherently unfair and tend towards the demonization of Hindus.
Have we not seen enough hate already?
But more people defended the idea of making caste part of the university's anti-discrimination policy.
caste has been a reality in India for thousands of years. It is not a colonial construct.
And it's clear by cases such as the recent Cisco lawsuit that this ideology is transferred here as well.
There are folks that are saying that caste hasn't affected their lives, but that is literally the definition of caste privilege.
Feigning ignorance is not going to make it go away. And if we have a way to protect and support a group of underrepresented students, what's stopping us from doing so?
Nothing stopped the Cal State Student Association. A week later, they passed the resolution, and their marathon meeting turned out to just be a preview of something bigger. In late April, the Santa Clara County Human Rights Council also held a hearing about possibly including caste specifically in their anti-discrimination policy. Their meeting lasted nearly 8 hours. A chorus of speakers again argued that introducing the concept of caste in the U.S. would only lead to discrimination against Hindus. They were organized in part by the Hindu American Foundation's Samir Kalra, a Santa Clara native.
We have gotten involved in the Santa Clara County Human Rights Commission, particularly because there's a large number of Indian Americans in Santa Clara County. It's kind of the hub of Silicon Valley. And because, you know, we felt that this was treading down a very dangerous path.
But the NAACP and Alphabet Workers Union, which represents employees at Google, voiced support for colleagues who identify as Dalit, known as the lowest caste. And at the Santa Clara hearing, many of those self-identified Dalit workers shared personal experiences of upper caste Indian co-workers discriminating against them. Some said nothing to their employers because they're H-1B visa holders and feared being deported. Others were fired when they spoke up.
I tried to explain that it's about caste, but they didn't want it to listen.
I was discriminated in the Bay Area because of my caste. It was not a single time, but many times.
Dominant caste people in this area have used slurs, engaged in physical assaults, verbal assaults, and have threatened people from my caste.
At home, we have no political power. But in the United States, we have rights. And yes, that's why I'm here, to protect these rights. Caste discrimination is real.
After hours of testimony, the exhausted Santa Clara commissioners said they plan to hold more hearings on the issue. The Cal State Student Association is still waiting on the California State University Board of Trustees to take action on their request to add caste to the system's anti-discrimination policy. Both sides in the debate say they're ready for a long fight as people in the U.S. work out how they'll handle the ancient issue of caste. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
That brings us to the end of the hour. Tomorrow on The World, we head to Kenya to learn about the effort to count all of the nation's animals, from elephants to anteaters, every single one. The World's Halima Gikandi went up in a plane with scientists to see how a wildlife census is done. She brings you that story tomorrow. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here tomorrow.